Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, a podcast from the Book Report Network, where we host in-depth conversations with authors about the books that we love. We know authors cannot travel everywhere, so we want to bring them to you, wherever you may be. Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, where our guest today is Susie Yang, who is the author of White Ivy, debut novel. It's already seen such great success. It was picked as a Read with Jenna, Jenna Bush, Today Show book selection for November, which is super exciting. We're looking forward to speaking with her today. So welcome, Susie.
Thank you for having me, Carol. I'm excited.
So if you could tell us a little bit about White Ivy, we'd love to get our readers up to speed on it.
Sure. So White Ivy tells the story of Ivy Lin, a Chinese American immigrant, and it follows her from when she's 14 to 27. She falls in love with a boy named Gideon Speyer, who is the son of a Massachusetts state senator. As adults, Ivy and Gideon reconnect, and the entire arc of the story is essentially Ivy lying, manipulating, scheming her way into Gideon's heart, and also into marrying into his very New England patrician family. And the novel kind of explores the sense of identity and class and really kind of reinvention as Ivy goes to greater lengths to get what she wants.
And she does go to great lengths to get what she wants. It opens with this really strong line. Ivy Lin was a thief, but you would never know it to look at her. So what are you telling the reader about her with that line? And was that always the first line?
Yeah, that was, not only was it the first line, but it was actually, it's like the pinnacle for the whole book. Like when I decided to write a book even, I knew that I wanted to kind of create like a very dark anti-heroine character. And her background, the way she looks, the way she walks and what she wants, I think it was all, it all boiled down to that first line. I wanted somebody who was very conniving, very ambitious, but also somebody who would be really underestimated. So the idea of her kind of looking like very childish, but on the inside, you know, being a thief, that became the kind of the pinnacle of Ivy's character.
Yeah, she is such a conniver. And she's, her background is something she's perpetually trying to overcome and reinvent herself. She's constantly with different goals in mind. Did she come to you fully formed, or did you play around a lot with her character?
Her character, I think, came to me fully formed, but with each of the drafts, I did 6 drafts with my editor, and I actually think that's when we really fleshed out what Ivy wanted. That was a big thing for us, because she would, you know, do all these things, but I felt like in the beginning, in the earlier versions, it was sort of like, I could see the reader getting lost, like, why is she going to these lengths? So it was really important to kind of really let the reader sink into her brain to figure out, like, why is she doing all these things, you know, what prompts her to do it, and what circumstances in her childhood informs, you know, inform these ambitions that she's so obsessed with as an adult. So I would say with each draft, the kind of the formation of Ivy's interiority became clearer.
Yeah. You know, at the beginning, her grandmother is coaching her on how to steal, which I absolutely love. And I love that where they were stealing was garage sales. I just thought that was, I haven't driven past a garage sale the same way since I finished the book. Because I'm like, who's out there stealing and what are they taking from the garage sale? But it was really funny because it's like, well, they won't really miss it later and it's not really a big deal and all this kind of, but it was kind of like the garage sale. Where did that part come up with of like, this is where she is?
Yeah. That came to me because when I was a kid, I would go to yard sales with my own grandmother. So this was, so I've lived on and off kind of with both my grandparents. They would come to China and stay with us for a few years. So my paternal grandmother, she was the one who loved shopping. So she loved going to, you know, garage sales, yard sales. And as a kid, I think I was, you know, 7 or 8, I was essentially her translator. So on the weekend, she would just, you know, I think we were living in Baltimore, in the suburbs of Baltimore at the time. And there were a lot of yard sales. Like, I don't really know how she even found them. But yeah, every weekend, there'd be a new yard sale. And we'd see the sign on the trees, and we would go. And she would just love kind of exploring, I don't know what it was, like tableware and clothes, and just had a really fun time browsing. So when I thought, oh, Ivy's a thief, and you know, you have the obvious places to shoplift, like Kmart or, you know, Goodwill. But then I thought, oh, how interesting if she's taught how to, you know, essentially the value of something by her grandmother from the yard sale. So that was the influence for that scene.
Yeah. And it's just like, oh, wait, this item, but the way they're shopping the sale, it's like that one to take, don't take that. You know, very exquisite taste on what to be, you know, taking from the store.
And then she's also trying to do this in stores all the time. She's like, oh, wait, if I can get away with this. And it's almost like somebody of a certain age, and if you have a certain look, they're not going to pay attention to you. And I think that's what she was doing, is she was doing her Ivy Hyde kind of a thing. Oh, you don't see me. I'm in. So you have family in China. Did you spend a lot of time there?
So I was born in China. I came to the US when I was 5. And then between 5 and 14, I didn't go back at all. And then my first visit back was very similar to Ivy. That whole experience is actually extremely based on, you know, my own sense of culture shock. Oh, you know, I was born here, I've lived here as a kid, but I don't remember any of it. But since then, I think I've gone back almost every few years at least. So I've made, quite a few trips. All of my grandparents are still living in China, and I have a lot of aunts and cousins there as well.
Well, I also love when she gets there, she's living the dream. She has this aunt who takes her places, and they are luxury shopping. And she just thinks like, wait, this is not such a bad place. This is like my dream. Everything's just going super well. And then all of a sudden she goes and lives with the rest of the family, and it's anything but, and she's like, but you are the one. Why can't I just be with you? So it was really, because you were juxtapositioning culture so much. Because for Ivy, she's going to this very smart school. She's going to a school where everyone's very wealthy. She's there because she's on scholarship. So now she gets this taste of that world, but with her family. And then she's back to, so this poor child is going back and forth about aspiration, received, taken away, brought back. Is that a lot of what you were trying to talk about too?
Yeah. And I think that kind of what you were saying about being given something and having it been taken away, I think that informs so much of Ivy's character, which is a lack of security. Like, she never feels secure, right? She never feels like, oh, this is mine and I'll always have it. She always feels the sense of, you know, it could be taken away at any time. And then with the sense of, you know, the fairy godmother kind of section, I really wanted her to have that contrast, you know, between just what, like, her very almost insulated suburban life and then this idea of extreme wealth. And that's where she forms a lot of her taste for luxury goods and for material things. She sees, you know, how the other half live, I suppose. So that was a fun section to write.
And it's not just a yard sale. It's not just a yard sale. Like, you could do way much better. Grandma should only know how much, so much better you could do. It's like privilege class is such a theme. She wants what everybody has, but when she gets closer to what she wants, the more she has to look at what's real and what's an illusion. Mm. Like, she's got this really wealthy family and she wants to be like them. Was it interesting having her juggle, like, what you really want, but then who is it? Who are the Spire family? What are these people really being? There's this facade about them, but when you're with them every day, what is it like?
Yeah, I really think that, to me, the pleasure of writing the book was kind of figuring out for myself as the author, you know, what is everyone's agenda? What are they really like, you know, in my mind? But then how does Ivy see them? And then showing how Ivy sees them, but at the same time, allowing the reader to see more than Ivy is able to see. So that was really, I think that was a lot of the craft for me in writing it. I'm just really drawn to that, I guess. I like the idea of everybody, you know, not being honest about who they are and wanting to portray themselves a certain way. But because the whole book is kind of through Ivy's point of view, I want the reader to follow her as she discovers more and more about Gideon and about his family. You know, she's enamored with them, but then she sees these signs, you know, maybe things don't add up, but she doesn't want to see it. But to a certain extent, she also knows she probably doesn't want to see it. And she kind of accepts that, you know what, it's fine if it's not real because I'm not that real. So maybe we're a good match. That was the, I guess that was almost the conclusion that I wanted Ivy to kind of eventually come to, her ultimate downfall.
Ultimate, this is what's going to happen to you. You know, there's this morning where I love with Ivy's someplace she's not supposed to be. She's at a sleepover that she's not supposed to be. And she's done that typical teen thing lying of, I'm going to so-and-so's house. She gets dropped off there. She runs down the block. She goes to the real party she's supposed to be at with her boys, and she's going to sleep over. She's at the Spire's house. And the next morning, every teen's nightmare happens. Her, not just her parents show up to get her, her entire family shows up to get her. And there's this almost comic moment of it, of there's the parents, the grandmother, and her brother all, you must leave now, you must leave now, you must go. And I felt like for part of that book, that was like a comic relief kind of a scene of everything being so intense. Was that intentional that I'm picking that up?
Yeah, it was so intentional. I rewrote that scene dozens of times. And a lot of the rewriting was dialing it back. I felt like at a certain point, I think my editor was like, this is too much. Like, it's becoming a farce. You know, like, I think she was essentially saying, are you writing a satire? You know, it became a little bit too much. So I had to really kind of dial it back. I just wanted to show that kind of cringy teenage humiliation. You know, I wanted it to really sink into Ivy's bones. And I also wanted that scene to really kind of get the reader on Ivy's side. You know, we can all root for somebody who was embarrassed in that way, in a way that makes all of us feel like, oh my God, that's so horrible, you know, to be trying to be cool when you're 14, but to have your family show up and ruin it in front of the boy you like. So that was definitely deliberate. And I hope it evoked a visceral reaction in people.
It totally did. And then, like, you know, some people would say, okay, you're going to go to your room and you're not going to leave for like a month or something like that. No, you're going to China on the next flight. Pack your bags, you're out of here. You need to be away from these people. And I was just there like, you know, and this is for your own good. And this, I can just picture this child who thinks that she's conniving to get what she wants. You know, yard sales are leaving, I'm on a plane. And then she gets over there and she's in luxury haven. And then she goes to the rest of the family. This kid is getting whiplashed around a lot. What's going on?
Yeah, I didn't think about that. That is quite an extreme reaction on her parents' part.
Like, the plane is leaving tomorrow and you're on it, you know? It was like, okay. But, you know, I did love, because her dad is giving her this advice. Be humble and grateful for what you have. Don't expect too much from life. If you go looking, you'll always find people better than you. Mm. And there's a lot packed into that line that closes part two. I think people spend so much time on a quest of, who do I want to be? Who am I? And then every once in a while, you have to just get comfortable in your own skin. And I think he's trying to tell her to do that. Am I right on what he's sharing there?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So Shen, I always felt like he was sort of the voice of reason in a way in his family. You know, he doesn't say much, but I feel like, you know, he loves his family and he honestly has the most common sense, right? And so I feel like Ivy doesn't see that obviously about her own dad. So we all have a blind spot when it comes to her parents. So she takes that his advice as saying, you know, you're not as good as other people, right? Or you can't have, you know, don't overreach yourself. But I think you're absolutely right. My intention was that, you know, that was his way of saying, I mean, and he's not a man of a lot of words, right? So he doesn't really try to influence her. Or, you know, he kind of lets Ivy's mother take care of that. But he was essentially saying, like, he could see I guess you could see her dissatisfaction, right? And, you know, he can sense that from her. So essentially he's telling her, you know, be grateful, you know, be humble. I think it was really the humility that I wanted him to convey to her, in a sense of, you know, there will always be people who have more. And if you continuously, you know, try to go strive for more, that's not necessarily going to make you happy. But that's not how Ivy read it. So
No. And you also realize she's got this poor brother who is like completely confused on what's going on with everybody. And you see where, I mean, the mother is extremely strong. The grandmother's strong in her own right in a totally different way. Dad is quiet but sincere about where he's stepping back and looking. And the brother is sort of like lost in the mix of picture that, you know, you're the one that shows up at your sister's sleepover party and you know these people and, you know, she's getting yanked out the door. Your sister's then being shipped off. You see how this child would not want to leave his room. I mean, like, maybe if I leave my room, something really bad's going to happen and they haven't even dreamed up what they're going to do for me. You know?
Yeah. That dynamic was really interesting for me to write because I have a younger brother and I feel like growing up, there was very clear expectations that were very different for both of us. You know, it was like, I was the oldest and he was the youngest. And so much of, I guess, just even, you know, who was going to be responsible, who was supposed to be, you know, that take more initiative. Like, it was all the older child and the younger child was really, you know, they were just supposed to look at the older child as a role model. And I felt like poor Austin really got that second child, you know, Chinese parent treatment, which is like, you know, when his sister does something good, it's like, oh, look at her. And then when she does something bad, it's like, don't be like that. So I do feel like he does get lost. Like, there's always a comparison, right? And I think that's where his like loss of identity comes from as a kid.
Yeah. He's trying to figure out, you know, who I am.
Yeah.
And her obsession is this guy, Gideon Spire. She like just is absolutely, she wants Gideon. She wants Gideon's family. But Gideon to me seems like a lot less than who Ivy thinks he is. She's got this view of who he is. And I found myself wondering, what is she really seeing in this guy? Is he an escape from who her world is? Because he doesn't sound super special. He pays attention to her at the beginning. And I think she loves and craves that attention. But from there, he seems kind of like empty suity to me. Like, it's earnestly, but empty suit.
Yeah, no, Gideon was a really hard character to write because I also had that emotion about him. To me, it was so important to have them meet as kids because I think there's a line in there about Gideon being her idol and her idols are evergreen. And I really wanted that to be kind of the bedrock for Ivy. You know, I think if she had met him, you know, as an adult, she would have been like, okay, you know, he's, you know, good looking and smart, but not necessarily so special, right? But because she met him at that really impressionable age and, you know, then she moved away so abruptly and they never had that closure, I think to her, when they reunite and she runs into his sister, it does feel like destiny in a way to Ivy, right? She's kind of bored with her life as a teacher, as an adult, and she feels like, wait, maybe this is a chance to kind of continue something that had always been really unfinished in her mind. So I do think the reader, you know, has a much clearer idea of Gideon and his shortcomings and also his selfishness that Ivy doesn't see or chooses not to see because she is so, you know, she has these rose-tinted glasses based on her, like her adolescent emotions for him.
Mm-hmm. And his sister's also maneuvering it too. His sister's also maneuvering this all into place, which you find out much later, but it's like, what's going on? Yeah. There's a passage where she says she would have given anything to be like Gideon naturally, to be good, but she was not good. She was jealous, petty, vengeful. Experience taught her to hide these characteristics behind a veneer of sweetness and humility. Were there times where she was frustrating to you with as a character of how she had to be portrayed?
Oh, frustrating. Interesting. I think sometimes I would, you know, write her, and because I had a very like clear idea of her as very like selfish and also petty, like sometimes her voice will come out too strong and I felt like, oh, I need to dial that back. I think so much of this book is like dialing things back. Yeah. Like these characters are too unlikable or this situation is too satirical. So it really was trying to be more subtle and trying to show Ivy's humanity and not just, you know, her wickedness. Right. And I think I did that. I tried to do that at least mostly by showing her insecurities and showing mm-hmm. the times when she is humiliated or embarrassed or vulnerable. But yeah, I would say the frustrations is trying to juggle the two because I think sometimes her voice, at least when I'm writing it in a scene, can be so, you know, so mean in a way. Right. Yeah. So it was really trying to find the softness in Ivy and then trying to draw that out to make her more sympathetic.
Yeah, because she's very manipulative. And as a result, you're trying to figure out, like, well, where's the nice side of this girl? Because every single time, like, if she gets to their house, what room am I in? What is going to happen? You know, mm-hmm. and then she finds things like, oh, I'm not going to sleep with you. It doesn't happen in the house yet. The sister's sleeping mm-hmm. with her boyfriend. And it's like, wait, what is he actually telling me here? Like, am I as special as the other people in the house or am I not? You know, there's so many ways that she's challenged.
Yeah. That's such a good word. It was really just to throw things at her to see how she'll overcome them for me too, as the author. Yeah.
So at the same time, let's talk about, is it Rue Roman? Is that how it pronounced his name?
Yeah.
Rue
yeah.
Roman. He's the bad boy in the story. He's the bad boy. At the beginning, he's the good boy in the story because he's always helping Ivy out and he sees what Ivy's maneuvering to do. But he's trying to, okay, you want that dream? Let me help you get that dream. And then when you see that part of his personality, you see where he's going to play it for himself later on of getting whatever dream he wants. I don't want to give too much away. Beginning, he's supportive, but he knows her secrets. And that's a very powerful thing for him to play with because he gets her and he sees what he's going to do. And it's a dangerous game for both of them. And what draws her to him and him to her? Because they've got this contentious relationship right from the beginning.
Yeah, actually just hearing you say it, I feel like so much of Ivy's like adult desires are so informed by that childhood period because it's really similar with Rue. You know, they have that initial bond because she sees in him a fellow thief and a fellow like outsider and rule breaker. And they have that, you know, immediate connection where they're both stealing and breaking into people's homes, you know? And so they have that understanding. And then as adults, she can't sort of unsee him from, you know, how he was as a kid, even though he's now wealthy and he's able to, you know, buy her nice things. But at the same time, she's never respected him. So even as a kid, you know, she saw her as similar to herself, but those are the parts of herself she also doesn't respect. So in a way, they have so much similarity, but those are not the similarities that Ivy wants. So she's rejecting, you know, that part of herself that, you know, may have come from the bottom and, you know, is reinventing herself. And she thinks, oh, I don't want to be like Rue. I want to be like Gideon, who's naturally all these things. So that bond, it really is like for both Gideon and Rue comes so much from Ivy's opinions of them when they were, you know, kids. And then as they meet again, you know, she can't really see them as they are in the objective adults that they've become.
I also think that she's seeing that Rue is playing the game that they're playing as kids on a much bigger level. I mean, yeah. Rue has now taken what was a basic, like, you know, minor stealing game and has blown it up yeah. much bigger. The people he's associated with are more dangerous. She has not gone that dangerous route. And I think when she sees him a lot, I felt like she was seeing him of, oh, like, who you really took it over to the max, and I'm glad I didn't do that because yeah. I'm now going with the spires. Like, I'm now going to be with these other people, and she's torn between those two worlds.
Yeah, which is why it's so shocking for her when she sees Rue and Sylvia, because it's sort of like she can't, you know what I mean? It's like, oh, I thought he wasn't good enough for me, but he's good enough for her. So it was like that conflict in her as well. I think I had a line in there where she said, you know, when she saw them together, she wondered like what she had missed in Rue. Like her estimation of Rue went up because he was with Sylvia. And what's interesting is I also think Rue knows that. I think later on he says to her, you know, you only, you know, kind of want what other people want. And it is that sense, you know, that hollowness in her. She doesn't know what's good or bad, and she doesn't even know what to want. Like other people have to tell her, you know, this is good and this is valuable, because she can't really judge that for herself. And I think Rue is an example of that.
Well, I also think that he feels she's being played for a fool by the spires. And he feels like she's doing everything. And I actually felt that they seem pretty soulless. I mean, they have this facade of what's going on, but they're pretty soulless. And he's telling her, you're buying into this game because of what you want position-wise and whatever. But by the same token, what are you asking for? Like, what do you want? I might be a thief, but who are these people that you're playing a game to be part of?
No. Yeah, and she doesn't want to hear it. She's not interested in that, you know. She feels like his judgment is not valuable, you know. It's her judgment, and it's, you know, the spare's judgment that matter. And I think that caused a lot of friction in their later relationship, that he's so honest with her.
But she still shows up with him. Like, she still is that girl that calls in the middle of the night. It's like, okay, I'm on my way here. I'm on my, and she's constantly influxing herself back in her life. And you're trying to figure out, is that masochistic on your part? Like, or are you seeing you can be the real you, whereas you're trying with the spirits, you have to be this totally different person. You've got to be who they want you to be.
Yeah, it's probably both. I mean, I feel like all of us have a little bit of self-sabotage in us. You know what I mean? It's always like a little bit of like, oh, I've tried so hard. Let me relax. you know, let me unwind. And maybe I think for Ivy, Rue is that for her. You know, she feels such utter possession over him in a way she probably doesn't feel at all around the spares. It is a sense of security in a sense. She feels, I can make Rue do whatever and he'll always love me. You know, he adores me, etc. So it is that sense of, oh, I can be totally free and I have control over him. And that's not true, but she believes that for a long time, which is why she behaves, you know, so almost so entitled around him, right? So I think that's another layer of the dynamic as well.
Yeah, I'll show up, but you know what? I'm going back to them, but I am spending time with you, but I'm going back to that world. That's really my world. I step down every once in a while and come into your world. But he does have a lot of the material things that she loves. Yeah. And he's got that material aspect, but then she also has her, the first line of the book will come back to repeat herself here, because she's still a thief. I mean, she's still a complete thief. I'm not going to bring up, I don't want to spare, you know, share too much for the readers, but it's like, you know, she definitely is conniving still, but now she's playing the player, and that's a completely different game. You can play the people at the yard sale, but when you're playing the player, it's a different game.
I don't know if it's correct to say this. I feel like a lot of guys do that. Do you know what I mean? It's like, oh, I'll just come to you because I'll play you or whatever. You know, they're very cocky in that way. I feel like Ivy definitely has that. For all of her insecurities, I think she does know how, like, her own power over men. And that was pretty deliberate on my part. Like, I definitely wanted her to understand how to kind of ingratiate herself in that way, but also feel like she's the one in control, regardless of whether that's true or not.
And it's only with these two men who are very different. It's not like she's with every guy when she's out in the bar. She's not like every guy in the place. It's these two very different personalities that she's playing against. So it's not like she's a player across the whole room. And when she was with Gideon at the beginning, until Rue comes back on the scene, it's all about getting Gideon to do what she wants. And then Rue comes there, and then it's like, oh, well, I can play a game going back and forth now. It was interesting because it's not just everybody to her. She had her sights on two people in two totally different ways. But she knows that one at any moment could spill the beans about her and totally upset exactly where she is. You know?
Yeah, yeah, because she's too good to play the game, you know, because her roommate Andrea is kind of her foil in that sense. And she looks at Andrea, and Andrea's, you know, going out to bars, you know, clearly on the hunt and on the prowl for eligible, you know, bachelors. And Ivy's like, oh, you know, I'm too good to do that, right? But she's not, but she sort of knows that. So I think so much of Ivy's, at least to me, her endearing quality is that she knows how hypocritical she is. She like can't help herself. I think that's probably the tragedy, I think, of all like anti-hero characters, is that if they understand their own flaws, but can't help themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. And at one point, I'm not going to go into much, she takes on power. She takes on power and moves the game. She moves the chess pieces in the way she wants them. But then in the end, are the chess pieces really where she wants to be? It's the close of the book is just like, you know, so interesting from that point of view. You know, the grandmother says that one successful marriage feeds three generations. So let's talk about that, because it's like the successful marriage is going to take care of who?
So my editor loved that quote. And so I actually had it in two parts of the book. But that was something my dad told me when I was, so my dad and I were really close. And we had all these like huge, long philosophical discussions growing up. You know, I was 10, 11, 12. And I remember really early on, he said this to me, I think it was a Chinese proverb. And he, you know, kind of explained to me the importance, you know, of love and family and all that. But it's such a Chinese belief in the sense of, you know, if you have a successful union, it not only helps you, but it really helps your children. And it helps your parents who, you know, you can support in their old age, or if they, you know, have health issues. Like, so it's really it doesn't just talk about money. It's not just like, you know, if you're successful and you're, you know, well off, you can support people. It's really just about understanding and family stability and cultural understanding and just love, you know? So all these things, they think, will really benefit not just yourself, but your entire clan. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like that's a very, I don't want to say dutiful, but it really is, you know, it gives more meaning to love and marriage than just saying, oh, I like you, let's get married. You know, mm-hmm. It really is like two families coming together. And that was a concept that my dad and I talked a lot about. So when I wrote that scene and I had that one part where, so as a child, when Ivy hears this, she doesn't understand that. She feels like, oh, it's such a burden, right? No teenager cares about supporting
the whole family,
right? You just want to marry who you want. But that scene when she's at Thanksgiving and it's her family and Gideon's family, she sees her brother interacting with Gideon's parents, and she feels like, oh, wow, you know, if we actually became a family, then this could benefit, you know, not just myself, but we could all derive, you know, comfort and support and all, you know, all the rest of it. And that's where she understands the philosophy. Yeah, that was definitely something I pulled from my childhood memories.
Like, yeah. And it was interesting because I heard that your mother-in-law was very ill, but she did get to hear that you got the book deal. And I thought that was like, you know, this incredible moment that you got to share that this was going to be this big success to me. But let me just tell you, it's like, you know, wonderful news. So I love that you were able to do that, because I feel like everybody's rooting for you. You know, everybody's just figuring out what to do for you.
Thank you.
So you have this very successful career in tech. Like, you were doing like wonderful things. You had a tech company, everything was going very, very well. Did you always want to write? Did you always say, because there's such different applications of what you do and whatever.
Yeah. I always liked to write, but it was always a hobby for me. So even when I was a child, I was, you know, I was like getting paper together and making books, and I was, you know, drawing things. Always journaled, always wrote short stories, but I always thought it was a hobby, and my parents thought it was a hobby. I would get in trouble for writing because I wasn't studying, you know, no novels. I had to be doing homework. So I always thought, oh, maybe if I retire, I can be an author. But so I'd been running my startup company for around 3 years, and a whole bunch of different factors kind of came together. I call it my quarter life crisis. I was like 26, 27 at the time. I thought, oh my gosh, it's time to kind of try to pursue what I really want to do. And there's that nagging voice in the back of my head. So I gave myself a year to see if I could finish a book. So I'd always written chapter ones. I'm like a serial chapter one writer. My drawer is just so full of them. And so I thought, if I can't actually finish anything, I can't ever be a writer anyway. So let me just either kill the dream now or see if I can get it done. And that was how White Ivy came to be written.
Interesting. I was trying to say, did you give yourself a deadline? So was that 1 year deadline, and you made the 1 year deadline?
I made the 1 year deadline. Yeah, it was October. It was almost exactly 1 year. I wrote the first sentence in October of, I think 2016. And then 2017, I had finished it and then, you know, had my husband read it and then sent it over to who is now my agent. Yeah.
And I love the story that she was walking down the street reading it and dropping the pages.
I didn't know that. Yeah, I read that too.
When I was doing some research on you, she was, okay, so everybody, she's got this big manuscript and she's walking around New York reading it and she doesn't want to have to carry the whole thing. So she's putting pages in different garbage cans as she's walking down the street. And I thought it was just so perfect. I'm like, why did I ever think about that when I was carrying a really big manuscript? Because it wouldn't be a whole story anyplace, you know?
Why did you print it out to read it, right? Like, why not read it on your phone or something? Yeah.
But you know what's really funny is I can't read, like, if I was reading this book, a lot of times they'll say, oh, we'll just send you the ebook. No, because I make notes. I fold down pages. If you saw how I massacred the galley. And I do that and I'm making notes and I'm never writing in the book. I don't go that much, but I'll stick stickies in and I'll do all this kind of stuff, which you can't do. I've never found an effective way to do it in the ebook. And I feel like having the paper and walking away from a screen gives you a different sense of the book. And maybe it feels like it takes me closer to what the reader experience is going to be, though a lot of people are reading in E. But I think that visceral sense of turning the pages and knowing where you are in the stack, which you can't see the same way in E.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. I love, I love books. Because I move around so much, I would say 70% of what I'm constantly moving are my boxes of books. They're so heavy. They take up so much space, but I don't care. I have to buy them. And if I like a book, I like to buy them in all the editions. So I'll buy them in the UK edition because I like the covers, you know. I like the UK edition, the US edition. I'll do all the new editions. Yeah, it's great.
For your books, that's going to be really interesting. It's like, oh, yes, let's go put all this together, you know, all these different copies of the book. And it is funny because the covers can be interpreted so many different ways, and the way they handle the type and whatever can be so different according to what the country is and what they think is going to appeal to people. So the book sold in 2017, and then the editing process began. And you talked about there were six rounds of this. How close is this book that we're reading now to what you originally submitted?
I don't have like a context, a sense of saying, you know what I mean? It's more or less, but to me, it feels really different. I would say the skeletons are similar. So the plot has really stayed the same, you know, from following Ivan to the child to the end. That's never changed. So much of it was cutting. So I had a lot more scenes of Ivy's theft. You know, I think I had her going into different people's homes and shoplifting. There were more scenes with her and Rue as a child. So we cut that, and not even cut it, we really condensed it. And then the New Jersey scenes I worked on with Mary Sue, my editor, for quite a bit, just kind of boiling it down to the right themes. You know, before I had a lot of scenes, I think, with Ivy and her brother, or Ivy and her family. So it was really boiling down the dynamics of her family and their values. And then the adult scenes, I think there was another character. So the spare family is Gideon and Sylvia, but originally there was another sister. And Mary Sue had the brilliant idea of combining the two siblings. So Sylvia, as she is now, is actually, before, you know, Sylvia was very poised and very kind and gentle. And then I had the younger sister who was the brat, you know, she was the one who was very spoiled. So then I sort of combined the two and that made for such a more interesting character. So I felt like each draft really addressed one of these things. And then the later drafts, so Mary Sue likes to tell the story. She thought that the fourth draft was going to be the last draft and we were going to be done. So she told me, she said, it's almost ready. You just need to do these minor things. But that I heard, you know, you will never get to change anything else again. So you better change everything you want now. So that fourth draft, I think she said I changed something like 40 or 60% of it or something. I don't know. Wow. And I sent that back to her and that became draft 5. And she said she cried because everything was so different. But there were some good things and some parts I just, you know, was totally over edited. So then she kind of like Frankenstein the two and then sent me back her notes. And then the sixth draft became the final one that both of us are really happy with. So that was quite the process.
Which, you know, and it's the role of the editor and the way the editor works with you is so interesting because it may be we need two characters. I was talking to an author a couple of weeks ago, and she said the three characters in her book, one of the three was not even one of the voices in the book. And then all of a sudden she realizes, wait, she needs her own.
Yeah.
And I think that for readers, it's so interesting because you think that, oh, you write the book and then the book gets edited for like punctuation and spelling or something, but how much it's edited for plot and for plot, you know, making things tighter. And an author years ago sent me her manuscript and I said to her, the little boy was in the hospital room at some point, right? And she said, yeah. I said, well, he's still there. So she says, look at me. And I said, all of a sudden, there's like this random sentence. But you know, if you're the editor and the author and you've been so close to it,
yeah,
you can kind of miss that, like, wait, the little boy is still in the room and he's making this cameo for no reason whatsoever, you know? So it's interesting to pull back.
I mean, I loved working with Mary Sue and even just having readers, because I'm like, when I'm writing it, you know, it feels like I'm just making things up. I don't, you know, I'm pushing these people along, and then to have somebody fresh come and say, I love this, but this needs work. It feels like it feels so delightful because people are talking to you about characters that you made up, but it feels more real because then you can discuss these people and their motivations, you know, the way we're discussing them now. And that was really novel for me because they've only been, you know, I didn't let anyone read the manuscript as working on it. I didn't even tell that many people. And so for me, it was to hear, you know, Mary Sue and my agent Jenny and my husband, you know, talk about Ivy and Rune Gideon. It was like, oh, these people exist outside of my head. So that was really pleasurable. And especially for Mary Sue, I feel like really this book would not be this book without her. It wasn't just even about the small things, like the characters, it was the vision. Like she always came in with such a clear vision of, you know, the stark, complicated character. And she always knew, you know, the thriller part, and she always could tease out what was interesting. And I really trust that because I don't have a writing, you know, I didn't study writing. For me, I really approached writing the book as a reader. So to me, I would always go back, you know, what would be pleasurable to me as the reader? What would I want more of? Am I writing for myself? Because that was always going to be, you know, my motivation. So to have somebody say, you know, this is interesting, it's starting to lag here, this needs to be cut. To me, it was great. You know, these are my blind spots. So I really feel like this book wouldn't have been what it is today without her.
Yeah. And you know, sometimes everything is too precious. The writing is too precious, and you have to pull back from the preciousness to make it more approachable for the reader, and also to loop them in and sort of do this ebb and tide on the tension. Like it's, there's something that happens in the book that you totally would not see that coming earlier, but you realize it's the only thing that can happen at that point. And it's sort of out of the blue in a lot of ways, but it's totally what works.
And I feel like I'm the opposite of precious. I'm sort of the writer that's like, hey, Mary Sue, I wrote, you know, 10 new chapters and 10 new scenes for you. Which one do you like? So it feels like for me, it was the opposite. She didn't have to pry any words out of me. I think she had to filter. Yeah. She had to filter content from me. So yeah, I think I'm the sort of writer to like throw things at the wall and like try to figure out what works. So I think for me, readers are really essential. Yeah.
Yeah, and I had an author to work with recently, and she says she turned in 1,000 pages, and the editor says, and you can start on page 150, and it'll be just fine. You know?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the people who get to sometimes too close to their work, or and people don't allow themselves to be edited.
Yeah.
And there, you can tell sometimes in a book that there was fighting going back and forth, because it could be a better book. Something could be better if they would just been able to, you know, sort of decide what they were going to do.
Yeah.
So was White Ivy always the title? Was that always?
No, the original title that it sold under is Let Us Not Ask for Gold. And that comes from a poem that I had included in the first draft, which is Love is Enough, Let Us Not Ask for Gold. And it's very tongue in cheek because, you know, clearly love is not enough. And so that was a working title. And I think we decided to change it. Mary Sue thought that it didn't represent kind of the feel of the book. And so we kind of brainstormed for a new title. Oh my gosh, for months. We went back and forth. And then I think White Ivy was one of the options that I came up with and I sent her because I always thought the name Ivy was kind of evocative. I thought it had the right tone. And so I was just playing around with titles for Ivy. And one of the proverbs I'd really liked is the one that's included in this book, which is the snow goose need not bathe to make itself white. And I think that's where the inspiration for White Ivy comes from. And then everybody loved that book and that the title, and that was what it became later.
You know, and I also think, you know, who she wants to be culturally, it's there. Mm-hmm. And it's also Ivy is so much the Ivy League. And I just felt that, like, that, you know, oh, she wants to be this, that. It's it's just, you know, this was perfect. So the cover, was this it works so well with the story because you see this woman who's kind of like asserting herself a bit, but she's got her arms like this because so you can tell She's kind of like not completely comfortable in her skin. She's not standing assertively. She's kind of wrapped up. Was this always the cover, or was this what you played around with?
Yeah, so I got sent from Jackie, the art director, I want to say 5 or 6 different versions, and they were all really, really different. But one of the ones that we really loved was this black and white cover with White Ivy and my name. And I know I'm such a sucker for those types of books, because every time I go to the bookstore, I always pick up the books with, you know, the black and white cover with like a splash of color. And so I immediately loved that. But that cover had a different image of the woman. She had shorter hair. And then, so we thought it was a little bit too much like historical fiction, and she was posed differently. It was like very Jackie Kennedy-esque. And so we thought that it was more historical fiction, but because we liked the feel of it, I think this was maybe the 2nd or 3rd round. She came back with this cover and everybody loved it. Yeah. And that's what it became.
And it works well because when you finish reading the book, it's something if you're in a book club, you could actually talk about, because it's like the veil that Ivy's hiding herself behind. Yeah. There's just the way she's positioned, just everything. The cover is evocative and it just works so well. So Shonda Rhimes, gee, have we heard of Shonda Rhimes? She's a few shows. She's optioned White Ivy for Netflix as a limited series. And reading the book, I could actually see this playing out as segments. I can actually see, the different, you could see how it would play. You could see where that tension one would cut off that would make you watch the next episode, like, you know, everything along the way. What was it like taking meetings for the film deal? Did you actually do meetings with your agent and with the team there, or what was that like?
It was so shocking. it took all of June, essentially. So I got an email from my film agent, and he was like, you know, Amazon is interested. I think I can say this anyway. It was just, he told me he was interested. And then he set up the initial calls with the producers and TV runners. And I remember it was the most surreal feeling was, I got an email. I was in the UK, and it was like 8 p.m. or something. And he wrote, Shonda Rhimes is reading your book right now, because we had already gotten some other interest. And so she really wanted to, I guess, see if she was interested in putting in a bid as well. And so she was, and then he said something like, she will try to finish reading tonight. And so the whole time I'm just sitting there, like not doing anything, being like, Shonda's reading the book now. I'll just sit here as somewhere in the world, she's reading the book.
Reading my book.
Yeah.
What page is she on?
Yeah, yeah. Like, can I get real-time updates on this?
Is she laughing? Can we see some pictures? Is she getting it?
Can she film herself reading the book? Yeah. And then the next day, you know, he emailed me to say that she loved it. And then he set up calls between all the different producers who were interested. And then it took so many rounds and so many conversations until finally we decided to go with, obviously, Shonda and Netflix. So it really was just kind of out of the blue. So, like, I could get nothing else done. I just sat there and waited for emails to come into my inbox all day long. Right. Yeah, it really was such a crazy experience. And it was all locked down.
And Hollywood is completely different. I mean, you think publishing moves slowly. Hollywood, it's everything is slow, then everything's fast, and everything slows, and you don't hear for months, and then it's like, oh, you need a decision like right now on what to do. Well, I love that you and your husband have both been working from away. This is my favorite line, because we're not working from home, working from away during the pandemic. So you've been to Lisbon and Florence, and today you're in Istanbul. Like, if it's November, it must be Istanbul. So what made you decide to do this? And is it just because there's a moment to be able to?
No, I've always lived like this. I've always been a vagabond, like, really. So in Cambridge, I lived for almost 2 years, and that was the longest that I've ever lived anywhere after college. Back when I was doing the startup, so right out of college, I moved to San Francisco to work in tech and, you know, started different companies. But through that, I would just go where the opportunity led me. So I would live for 6 months. I lived for 6 months in Orange County, in Irvine. I lived for 6 months in Providence, Rhode Island. I shipped my car back and forth from California to New York, I think 3 times. I would go from Manhattan to San Francisco, back to Brooklyn, back to San Francisco again, then to Barcelona, and then to Thailand and Southeast Asia. And this was all before, you know, I started writing White Ivy. And so this is really the normal for me. I think people are now like, oh, you know, is it because of COVID or is it because of this? And I thought, no, this is really just,
this is my life.
This is my life. And it sounds a lot more, I guess, hectic than it is, because I'm actually quite a homebody. Like, truly, I'm a night owl. You know, I stay up all night writing. I don't get up until, you know, 2 or 3 in the afternoon, and I'll get coffee and then, you know, work. So I think for me, it's just because I'm such a homebody and because I live so much in my head, I think I need a change in environment as stimulation. Does that make sense? I think my brother and my friends, for example, who are extreme extroverts, they can live in one place, but they have such a rich life. You know, they love to see people and they have their clubs and their communities. And that gives them a lot of stimulation. And for me, because I'm so introverted and I tend to, you know, like being alone in solitude, I really am drawn to cities and different parts and travel because it kind of is, you know, the break from my own mind in that sense. So I think it sounds really strange to people, but really my life is so similar, right? I sit down, I work, you know, on the weekends I'll take walks, but just hopefully different walks and get to see something new. Yeah. So it really is quite the norm for me.
Now, do you know where you'll be in December and January? Do you plot ahead or do you sort of do like more whim of where to go?
A little bit of both. I mean, we're trying to be, obviously we're in a pandemic, so it's really just being safe in that sense. We're still based in Cambridge and London because that's where my husband's company is, but they worked remotely starting from September. So we're kind of still waiting to see what happens with them, you know, if they're going to be going back to the office. But so it really depends. I think we just want the flexibility.
Well, it was interesting. Yesterday I was reading that there's this little town called Salida in Colorado. And I know this town because I actually met my husband in Colorado, spent a lot of time there. And this town is doing booming business because people want to come there for the weekend or for a week. And it's just really interesting to see how people's lives have changed. And I think it's changed kind of permanently because people are seeing you don't have to be blocked into place. And I think for so long we thought that we did. And you can be more nomadic, adjusting your hours according to what you need to be doing. It's like 9:30 in Istanbul right now, but it's just basically figuring out what you need to do in order to have a very different life instead of the one where you traveled a lot before. Yeah. But a lot of people were very plugged into, I need to be here on a certain date every single day. And now if you're going to zoom in, it doesn't really matter where you are. Just pay attention to the time.
I love that too. I love that we can talk like this and afterward, you know, both of us can go watch Netflix, you know, as opposed to kind of the toll it would take normally for people to travel to a place. And before I always thought, you know, are people, you know, do they feel more distant, you know, in the sense if it's not in person? I think you do lose some of that. Like my husband really misses working, you know, with the team in person. But I was talking to, I think a librarian, she was saying how it's really nice because there were a lot, she's based in Florida. But so she's always, you know, really envious of the events in New York and she couldn't attend them, but now they're all online. So she says it's really great to be able to just stream them. And I thought that was really nice that people can have access if they want.
Yeah, because what I'll do is at night, I'll look down like a roster of what's on and I'll just go watch all different author events that if I was in the city, look, we worked in New York. Our office was in New York. You saw a lot of people come through New York. Yeah. You might not have come in New York when your book was out. You might have come for a marketing meeting.
Yeah.
You might not have come at a time where I could interview you. Whereas now we have a lot more flexibility with people. And even you can catch people 2 months after the book comes out if something interesting is happening. So it's completely working.
And I don't know if you feel this way, but I feel like the kind of content I'm interested in consuming has changed so much because of the past 6 months. Like now I'm so drawn to like podcasts and conversations and like vlogs of people just recording themselves cooking or like, you know what I mean? Like washing vegetables or like, you know, like going for a walk or picnic, just like everyday things. It's just so relaxing. I don't know if there's a genre for this, you know, lifestyle, whatever, reality lifestyle or whatever. It's just so relaxing to consume that kind of content now.
I think it's become more real. I think a world was a lot more fake. And I find that like when a newscaster is broadcasting from their basement and you see what's in the background or they're at their dining room table or whatever, you're just seeing people in a different way. Whereas everything was so sculptedly perfect before. And now it just may not be. It may not be the most perfect. And you're more into the conversation and you're more into thoughts and ideas than everything else being, it's just all perfect every single moment. No, things happen.
Yeah, I want like
child will content. Walk in.
Yeah.
remember a couple of years ago, the guy from the BBC and his child.
Daughter, and he was like trying to hide her.
and the mother comes in and snatches the one in the walker out. That's now every day. Like that is now not something special. And when you think about how that went viral when it ended up happening, because why? It was so different from the business world that we sculpted for ourselves. And now it's like, here's real life. Here's real life.
Yeah.
So with that in mind, you're working on something now? You're working on a new book?
Yeah, I think I'm really stuck in the weeds with this one. I'm around 2/3 of the way through the first draft of the second book. It deals with, I think, some more themes. So it also follows romantic relationship for around a decade. And it kind of dissects the dichotomy between the public persona and the private self. And it kind of deals a lot with similar themes like identity and reinvention and how to discern, you know, what our appearance is and what is the nature of a person. I think I'm still trying to talk about it in like an articulate way.
But you're also you're figuring out what the story is. You're trying to figure out, you know, what it is. But I think that what you're on to something is, because everything is so sculpted these days, like the way people present themselves on social media, especially, and who are they behind the scenes? Mm. Like I said, does no one child ever cry? Like children are never unhappy. They're all like blissfully doing fabulous things.
Yeah.
And I think there's enormous pressure on people right now to edit the story that they're delivering of their lives.
Yeah.
To edit the story. And you think about Ivy, like how would she be presenting herself online? What would she end up doing? We know Ivy in her real life. Well, what was she saying? What would her pictures have looked like? What would Ivy's Instagram have looked like? And you would never have seen people's insecurities. It never comes through of the insecurity. It always comes through of perfection.
And also because everybody is remote, and I feel like it's just such a global culture now, right? You can have one person recording like a TikTok video and everybody else can watch it around the world. So there's a sense of like cultural meshing and assimilation, but I think that also adds to a sense of otherness, you know, which is such a big theme in my book, because where do we belong then, right? Like, I think the idea of one person belonging to one specific culture is really dying out. I think most of us at this point feel like we don't belong to something, you know, I'm different than my neighbors or my classmates or whatever. And so it's also that I'm also really drawn to, this feeling of who am I, you know, who am I really, who is my tribe? And trying to find that, I think, is what I'm grappling with too.
And it's funny when you sit there and say that, you know, you're not an extrovert, you're more of an introvert. Everybody thinks I'm very extrovert. They don't understand on the weekend, I'm perfectly happy.
Yeah.
Sit and read White Ivy and make notes and not go out and do things. People say, how do you get so much done? And I said, it's simply because they're all the things I don't do. I don't go shopping.
Yeah.
I don't go out to lunch. I don't, your whole like things that you're just more efficient about, and then you can get a lot more done in life. But I think people, like small talk, you know,
I feel like people think that introverts mean like socially awkward, you know what I mean? Or you're like really quiet, or like, you know, you don't actually know how to carry a conversation, but I know exactly what you mean. It's more of just where you derive energy from and needing like that break, you know,
right,
to protect your private space. Yeah.
Yeah. Because there's just too much going on.
Yeah.
Well, this has been such a pleasure. I'm glad we could connect in Istanbul. Look at this, the power of Zoom. That was something we didn't even know about in March. I mean, you talk about the thing of the four-letter word of the year. It's like, you know, Times Person of the Year should be Zoom, because Zoom was like, you know, Zoom was it. I mean, there was no person. There's just Zoom. And Zoom connected you with all the other people. So there's my prediction for Person of the Year. So,
wow, it flew by. Thank you.
Yeah, it's such a pleasure to speak with you. Congratulations on the early success. I look forward to seeing you interviewed by Jenna. That should be really, really fun.
Super nervous, but hopefully I won't make a fool of myself.
No. It'll be absolutely wonderful. So thank you for joining us. Look forward to next book next time.
Thank you. Thank you and for having
readers,
me.
Yeah, and to our readers, thanks for joining us today. And we'll be back next time with Book Reporter Talks To. Keep listening for an audio excerpt from White Ivy by Susie Yang, narrated by Emily Wu, coming up after the credits, courtesy of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Book Reporter Talks To. You can read more about the author and the books discussed in this episode in our show notes, which can be found on our website, bookreporter.com. There are three ways you can support this podcast. First, subscribe so you never miss an episode. Second, share it or tell a friend about it. And third, rate or review us, as that will help people discover us. This episode is brought to you by the Book Report Network. Thank you to our producer of today's episode, Austin Rue.
Thanks to our research assistant, Emily Dankeese. And now, hear an audio excerpt from White Ivy, courtesy of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Ivy Lynn was a thief, but you would never know it to look at her. Maybe that was the problem. No one ever suspected. And that made her reckless. Her features were so average and nondescript that the brain only needed a split second to develop a complete understanding of her. Skinny Asian girl, quiet, overly docile around adults in uniforms. She had a way of walking, shoulders forward, chin tucked under, arms barely swinging, that rendered her invisible in the way of pigeons and janitors. Ivy would have traded her face 1,000 times over for a blue-eyed, blonde-haired version like the Satterfield twins, or even a red-headed, freckly version like Liza Johnson, instead of her own Chinese one with its too thin lips, embarrassingly high forehead, two fleshy cheeks like ripe apples before the autumn pickings. Because of those cheeks, at 14 years old, she was often mistaken for an elementary school student. An unfortunate hindrance in everything except thieving, in which her childlike looks were a useful camouflage. Ivy's only source of vanity was her eyes. They were pleasingly round, symmetrically situated, cocoa brown in color, with crescent corners dipped in like the ends of a stuffed dumpling. Her grandmother had trimmed her lashes when she was a baby to stimulate growth, and it seemed to have worked. For now she was blessed with a flurry of thick black lashes that other girls could only achieve with copious layers of mascara, and not even then. By any standard, she had nice eyes, but especially for a Chinese girl, and they saved her from an otherwise plain face. So how exactly had this unassuming big-eyed girl come to thieving? In the same way water trickles into even the tiniest cracks between boulders, her personality had formed into crooked shapes around the hard structure of her Chinese upbringing. When Ivy was 2 years old, her parents immigrated to the United States and left her in the care of her maternal grandmother, Mei Feng, in their hometown of Chongqing. Of her next 3 years in China, she remembered very little, except one vivid memory of pressing her face into the scratchy fibers of her grandmother's coat, shouting, "You tricked me! You tricked me!" after she realized Mei Feng had abandoned her to the care of a neighbor to take an extra clerical shift. Even then, Ivy had none of the undiscerning friendliness of other children. Her love was passionate, but singular. Complete devotion, or none at all. When Ivy turned 5, Nan and Shen Lin had finally saved enough money to send for their daughter. "You'll go and live in a wonderful state in America," Mei Feng told her, "called Massachusetts." She'd seen the photographs her parents mailed home. Pastoral scenes of ponds, square lawns, blue skies, trees that only bloomed vibrant pink and fuchsia flowers, which her pale-cheeked mother, whom she could no longer remember, was always holding by thin branches that resembled the sticks of sugared plums Ivy ate on New Year's. All this caused much excitement for the journey. She adored taking trips with her grandmother. But at the last minute, after handing Ivy off to a smartly dressed flight attendant with fascinating gold buttons on her vest, Mei Feng disappeared into the airport crowd. Ivy threw up on the airplane and cried nearly the entire flight. Upon landing at Logan Airport, she howled as the flight attendant pushed her toward two Asian strangers waiting at the gate, with a screaming baby no larger than the daikon radishes she used to help Mei Feng pull out of their soil, crusty smears all over his clenched white fists. Ivy dragged her feet, tripped over a shoelace, and landed on her knees.
"Stand up now,"
said the man, offering his hand. The woman continued to rock the baby. She addressed her husband in a weary tone.
"Where are her suitcases?"
Ivy wiped her face and took the man's hand. She had already intuited that tears would have no place with these brick-faced people. So different from the gregarious aunties in China who'd coax her with a fresh box of chalk or white rabbit taffies should she display the slightest sign of displeasure. This became Ivy's earliest memory of her family. Shen Lin's hard, calloused fingers over her own, his particular scent of tobacco and minty toothpaste, the clear winter light flitting in through the floor-to-ceiling windows beyond which airplanes were taking off and landing. Her brother, Austin, no more than a little sack and smelly diapers in Nan's arms. Walking among them, but not one of them, Ivy felt a queer, dissociative sensation. Not unlike being submerged in a bathtub, where everything felt both expansive and compressed. In years to come, whenever she felt like crying, she would invoke this feeling of being submerged, and the tears would dissipate across her eyes in a thin, glistening film, disappearing into the bath water.